You are listening to the Coming Up for Air podcast hosted by Air Moms Lori McDougall and Annie Highwater. This podcast is sponsored by AlliesInRecovery.net. Coming Up for Air brings together two wonderful people, both of whose adult sons are in recovery from opiate addiction. Annie Highwater and Lori McDougall have both been through years of their loved one's active addiction. They've experienced all the difficult emotions, the guilt, the anger, the fear, the shame, the exasperating arguments, highs and lows, crises, and relapses. They have come to understand the direct link between taking care of yourself and being able to help your loved one. They have shepherded their loved ones toward treatment. Their sons are both in recovery today. During these conversations, Lori and Annie address the questions and concerns brought up by Allies in Recovery members. And now, Coming Up for Air with Lori McDougall and Annie Highwater.
Hi, Annie.
Hello. Good afternoon.
So we're back again today on Coming Up for Air, and today's topic is the big enabling.
Yeah, that's a common one out in this field. And you'll have to bear with me. I'm just starting to get my voice back.
No problem. Let's see. So I figured I'd kind of just give you an idea of, just to kind of give you some background of my view of enabling, because I struggled with this when I first was introduced to this issue. I heard it constantly, and it really, really confused me, because I really felt that I was not a big enabler. I really felt that I had done a lot of work to try and make sure that I wasn't contributing to his issues. And I think looking back, I'm sure that I can absolutely come up with times that when I was enabling.
Well, sometimes I think you get fooled into enabling and you don't realize you're doing it too.
Right, exactly. So I'm sure I can look back and I can say, okay, yeah, I was definitely enabling here. I was definitely enabling there. But a lot of what was said to me, by other people, you know, by people outside of my situation, in support groups, enabling troubled me a lot. because I don't think I did some of the typical, I don't want to say typical. I guess that's not quite the right word, but some of the things that a lot of people did, simply because I don't know why. I don't know why I didn't do
them. Maybe you've done the research, or, you know, I always say I refer back to a lot of it in my book, just because I don't think you need to get into every single detail over and over. But my mom was my son's enabler, or at least she was the one who made it easier for him to stay dependent, have access, keep it a secret, things like that. So because she had that approach, I took the harder approach and I studied non-enabling ways. And I thought I was the model citizen, non-enabler, consequence-forcing, Aaron Brockovich, perfect role model of we are handling this right. So, and it blew up in my face that way too.
Right. And because Tommy had been bipolar and I had been dealing with him being bipolar for such a long period of time, that setting down boundaries, setting up consequences, or making sure that natural consequences occurred, trying to allow things to happen as they would, like allow him to learn from relationships with other people, that just carried into it when we started having issues. I think there probably were times that I did contribute to the problem, that I did enable it. But I don't think I think I just had enough education from dealing with his previous issues that it was easier for me to grasp that, you know, like I've heard people say things like, you know, well, I gave him $40. He asked me, he told me he wanted to go to the movies and he wanted $40. And so I gave it to him, but I had a feeling that he was going to go and buy drugs. I never had situations like that with him. He didn't, you know, he also was highly functioning. So he was working and making his own money and exercising. And so there wasn't ever a need for him to come to us with that stuff, if that makes sense.
Right. So you like, and I've heard a lot of moms that say, I was in a panic and I drove him to pay off a drug dealer. And on right. the way there, he said, oh no, the amount's increased. It's not 200, it's 700. So I took him and got the additional amount. And I've heard those stories over and over. Right. And one mom said she did that for 3 or 4 years and drained thousands. And that's a learning curve too. And now she's like, I'm not giving you $5 for the bus, you know?
Right, right.
I didn't have any of that either, but I remember when my son got his first apartment and was doing well, I surprised him and furnished it from top to bottom before he moved in, thousands of dollars, so that when he came home, every bit of silverware was in the drawers. I mean, just the foolishness. But I was so excited that he was doing, because my son always worked as well, too. He wasn't one to really hold the couch down. But when he got that apartment, I didn't let him go have the benefit of buying those things and caring about him for himself. I was really just like, I want to bless you and help you. And I didn't have anybody do this for me. Plus you're doing so well. And boy, was that a mistake. That was not my place to do that. And I feel like that was a big enabling on my part.
Right. And well, I guess, you know, and having heard that story, I guess not so much me. I think more my husband, believe it or not, did a lot more of that than I did, because I do remember a time, and this was actually when he was down in Florida. He was at a treatment facility. He had come out. He was in a sober house, and he was he got a job, and he needed transportation. And I dug my feet in and was, do not buy him a car. He doesn't need a car. He can take the public transportation. I know I did when I was young. There's no reason why he can't, you know, let's, instead of getting him a car, let's buy him a bus pass. You know, that was my, my thing. My husband dug his feet in and said, no, we're going to buy him a car. And he did. He did buy him a car. And his whole reasoning was, well, he needs transportation in order to get to work. So I guess, yeah, I guess that's enabling. It might not have been me directly, but it was within the marriage, I guess.
Well, how much more do you appreciate something you've had to work for? I remember when my son first got out, he's gone between California and Texas, back and forth, and he went on a trip to Texas from Southern California and called me and said he brought the wrong shoes. And I had said, I kind of have this rule after everything we've been through. I have no problem showering you on your birthday and Christmas, but I'm not going to buy adult things. You know, just right now it's my bottom line for a while. That may change in 10 years, but we've been through a lot. And so he said, well, I don't have shoes here. And I said, well, it's better than having no feet. And he went to a mall and said he walked in his socks and bought a pair of his favorite pair of shoes. And he's like, I'm telling you what, Mom, I love telling that story. I love that I earned those shoes and you made me go take care of that myself instead of having Amazon ship them to me.
Right, right. And I've heard a lot of stories where, actually, I've heard a lot of shoe stories, because apparently there's this thing down in Florida in the sober living community where they convince their parents that they need a pair of boots for work. And the parents will give them the money or whatever to go and buy these boots, or will even just buy the boots for them, and then the kids will take the boots and go sell them for the money. Yeah, I know. Great, right?
You really just have to be aware.
Right.
So enabling takes on a lot of forms. And if I can just interject this in really quick, because it is so broad, I pulled a psychology article and it has 7 signs you might be enabling. So this is for any listeners, not just us, because I know we're a little bit seasoned in the game now. Not that it can't repeat, but okay. Here are 7 signs you might be enabling. If you are,
I'm going to write them down. So,
okay. If you are ignoring your addicted loved ones' negative or potentially dangerous behavior, it can involve anything from overlooking problems to denying that a problem even exists. That's number one. Number two, if you have difficulty expressing emotions, enablers are often unsure how to express their feelings, especially if there may be negative repercussions. Number three, if you prioritize your addicted loved one's needs above your own, while it's natural to want to help loved ones, enabling takes helping a step too far. It's kind of mercy out of balance. When the addicted loved one has his or her needs taken care of, while the enabler tends to neglect their own. Number four, if you're acting out of fear, since addiction can cause frightening events, the enabler will do whatever it takes to avoid such situations. Number five, lying to others to cover addictive behavior. An enabler will lie to keep peace and to present a controlled, calm appearance, an appearance of things or of themselves or whatever. Number six, blaming people or situations other than the addicted loved one. To protect that loved one from the consequences of drug abuse, the enabler might accuse other people of causing it. You pushed his buttons, or we have to tiptoe around it, or whatever the case may be. And number seven, if you are resenting the person you're helping, the result of the above behaviors is that the enabler will likely feel angry and hurt. The enabler may act on these feelings by resenting the addicted loved one, all the while continuing to enable the addiction. If you notice these behaviors in yourself or a loved one, you may be enabling addiction. And then there's four quick tips that follow that, breaking the cycle. Leave messes as they are. Don't clean up anybody's messes. I don't like cleaning up a mess I didn't make. Weigh the options of short-term versus long-term pain. Will helping one more time cause pain in the long run? Will it cause future demands and pressure? You know what I mean? Like once they know when what point they can wear you down, they just have to go to that point again or a little more. Get back to autonomy. That's freedom and independence. Don't allow yourself to be put in danger. Be free of their consequences. And make sure you develop consistency, because consistency is vital. If sometimes you give in because you're tired or weak or fed up or it's easier, that's a problem. You break the cycle by being consistent. So that was an interesting read for me.
Right. I you know, I love this. And it kind of goes along with a few things that I did some research on myself when talking about enabling. And it kind of, I think kind of piggybacks on what you were talking about. So I actually wrote out a few questions that I ask myself when I'm trying to determine if I think I'm enabling or I'm getting close to that kind of behavior myself. So I figure I'll just share those with you because that kind of goes along with what you just said. First question is, what are my motives?
I right? love that question.
What are my motives? Because my thing is, when I ask, well, why am I doing this? When I ask that and I kind of reflect on that particular question, I find that sometimes I'm doing things because I'm afraid of what someone else will do.
Right.
Or I'm afraid of what will happen. And so I'm trying to keep that from happening. Right. So just for example, I'm just trying to think of being afraid or paying off debts to a drug dealer, just using that example, right? Your son or your daughter comes to you. Oh my God, he's going to kill me. You know, I owe him $100. I've got to pay.
He's going to kill the whole family.
Right. He's going to kill the whole family. You know, what am I going to do? Please, you've got to give me the money or I'm going to die. Well, you know, you do have, the motive is, I guess, to give the money would be to keep that from happening, when chances are that's not going to happen. But the other thing is there are alternatives to giving them the money. And we don't think about that in the middle when they're wreaking havoc on us, when they're trying to use fear and trying to manipulate us into doing what they want. There are alternatives. Like, you know what? I hear that you're scared to death about this drug dealer wanting his money. I have another way that maybe we could handle this situation. The only thing I'm willing to back up is if you go into treatment, right? One thing I'll help you with, I will help
you. And there you're going to be safe. You're going to be safe in treatment.
You're going to be safe there. And maybe we can get you into a facility or something that's not in the area so they won't even know where you are.
Right. And then they'll have to come deal with us.
Right. They'll have to come deal with us.
Right. I love that question. That question, I try to use that every time I can. I mean, I remember there were times that I would try to force separation between my son and my mom, and I would investigate and threaten and give consequences. If you talk to her, if you call him one more time, and I would have to step back and say, what's my motive here? This is me being full of bitterness and resentment from years past. This has nothing to do with whether it's right or wrong, good or bad, for her to call him. This is all about me. That's a great question to always, in the midst of crisis or drama or anything that's big going on and decisions have to be made, what's my motive is a fantastic starting point.
Right, which actually, just what you said, it leads into the other question that I asked myself is, am I doing what is best for me? Is this best for me? Am I giving up on my own morals and values? Which is like, when I see a homeless person on the street asking for money, I don't give them money. Why don't I give them money? I don't give them money. I'll give them clothes. I'll give them a blanket. I'll give them food, but I won't give them money because I'm not sure where my money's going to go. And I don't want my money to go towards drugs or alcohol. So why would I give my son or my daughter, the person that I love the most, you know, in this world, why would I give them money? Why would I put aside my own values in order to, or my own morals, my own values in order to, I guess the only reason I might do that is because of fear, because I'm afraid they're going to go do something else that might hurt them.
And I'm telling you, you go a few rounds of it, that fear becomes less ominous and you get a lot better at handling it in the moment to where you're not ambushed with it to make a quick decision. And you can take that 90 seconds, or I know you take a little bit more time on things to make a decision, check your motives, what's best. But in the first initial phases of it, you're immediately like, they're coming to kill us. It's a learning curve. It's a process. You don't get good at handling this kind of insanity overnight, especially how insane the fear can get. And they will work your fear.
Right. Well, which brings me to, do I resent what I'm doing? Right?
Right.
Do I resent? So if I am resentful of something, that brings me to a couple of things. It brings me to, don't do it. If there's resentment in there, I shouldn't be doing this, because that means I also have an expectation, because to me, expectation and resentment are linked. So if I'm resentful, it's because I have an expectation and the person probably isn't living up to it. And then I also have an expectation that because they're not going to live up to my expectation in the future with whatever I'm doing, I can continue to be angry and belligerent towards them, or, well, I can blame them. So I don't want to have resentment. So I'm not going to do it. If I have any resentment at all, I'm not doing it.
I have to tell you, I have the best example of it. I observed a conversation about exactly that was so powerfully revealing, where a counselor was talking to a husband and wife, and I just happened to be sitting close by the conversation and kind of eavesdropping, and they were talking about how addiction had just ripped through their family over the last year, and as a result, they had moved into a different home and taken on additional kids beside their own. And they were saying, here we work all these hours and then we come home and we've got this many more kids to take care of. And the counselor said, well, this is going to sound really rough, but follow me on this. You've got choices to make, and those kids can go into foster care. And that couple looked like, what? You know, how could you say that? We could never do that. And he said, well, let me put it this way. If you took those kids on out of the goodness of your heart, that doesn't really make you a saint. That was a choice you made. And you're going to work all day and coming home and letting them know what favor you're doing them. But maybe a foster care would welcome them and love them and be glad to pour out while you're kind of letting everyone know that you resent this help you're giving. And that was such a eye-opening thing for me mm-hmm. in areas of my own life where I think, oh, I'm doing the right thing here. I'm helping this person out, or I've put in this time and effort. I mean, that's a really victim mentality when you think,
right.
I'm doing all this work, you know, like you have a choice not to do all that work. If you're just going to complain and blow it up of what a big task you've taken on, you're really letting everyone know what a bother they are.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And I think that brings us back to control.
Right.
You're trying when you're doing that, you're trying to control the outcome, right? You're trying to control what's going on, and you can't control. And all you can do is if you go ahead and you enable, right? If you go ahead and you try and control and you enable, then what you're actually doing is contributing, which we've talked about in the past. You're contributing to the disease, right? You're being a part of it.
And I can honestly add, anyone I have ever tried to control ended up controlling me.
Right. Right. Exactly. And also, there were a couple of things that I wrote down about this. The other thing about it is that am I doing this because I love my loved one, or am I doing this because I don't want to face something?
Yeah.
Right.
I don't want to face them going to jail or dying or something terrible happening.
Exactly.
Or even an argument and backlash.
Right. Right. So I think I'm protecting them, when in fact, maybe I need to let them learn their own lesson. I'm getting in the way of them learning
something that they need to strengthen them.
Right.
Anything I've stepped in the way of my son figuring out a consequence or carrying his own load has robbed him of something he needed to accomplish and develop within himself.
Right.
I always have this rule that I always say, I don't mind helping someone bear their burden, but I'm not going to shoulder anyone's load. I'm not going to carry another adult. That's different than pitching in, helping out, encouraging for a span of time, helping. That's a lot different than carrying an adult's responsibilities.
Right. Right. And you know, this brings me all back to allies in recovery, right? It brings me all back to AIR, because I think this is the essence of what allies in recovery and the CRAFT method is. It's all about enabling and not enabling. It's all about not enabling bad behavior, but enabling good behavior, right? It's all about identifying when I can contribute to someone in a more positive direction. I can encourage sobriety or treatment, and when do I need to back away? When do I need to let them go out there and kind of learn their lessons? And I love like Dominique's example on the website. I don't know if you've seen this particular video, but the one where, or I've heard her describe this as well, where she talks about, let's say your loved one is not living in your house and they're still out on the streets and they're using, or maybe they're not on the streets, maybe they're at a friend's house and they're using, and you call them up and you say, hey, let's meet for lunch. I'd really like to spend some time with you. And your goal is to reward them or enable good behavior. And so when you show up for lunch and you try and identify, are they high, are they not high, which is huge for AIR, right? That's what it's all about. Identify those moments when they're high and when they're not high. If they're high, you're gone. You don't want to be there, right? Because your presence can be a reward. So you get there, you get to lunch, you invite them to lunch, you ask yourself, are they high, are they not high? If they're high, I see you're not having a great day today. Maybe we can try this again next week, right? And you walk out of the lunch place and say, I'll give you a call next week and we'll see if we can do this again. And you leave, right?
Yes.
To me, that is a perfect indication where you're not enabling that bad behavior. It's a chance right there to say, look, I'm not gonna be a part of you using, but I will. I'm not gonna shut the door either. I'm gonna continue on with our communication, and then calling the person next week. Okay, we'll try it again. You show up, and they're not high. Great. Oh, I see you. You know, you look good today. Let's sit down. You sit, you have lunch. And then you say something like, you know what? I really appreciate that you took the effort to spend this time and not use and be with me. Come on outside. I have something I'd like to give you. And, you know, have a bag of groceries or something in the car. And you give them a bag of groceries and you say, hey, maybe we can do this again next week. So to me, I love her examples of, okay, you know, when am I enabling? When am I rewarding? When am I not rewarding? And
I just have to add to that, just that, that my son's been about 4 years in recovery. So I hope he doesn't relapse. It's possible, but I haven't dealt with active addiction in a long time. But my mother is prescribed medication, so she's never not on it. So I can't wrap my life around whether she's on it or not. I have to wrap it around whether I feel safe and healthy or not, whether there's going to be conflict and poison or frustration, and only I can control that. Mm-hmm. Because I have to go into every setting knowing it's not an issue of her not being on something or not. She's prescribed a large amount of narcotics, and that's just what it is. So can I handle these situations? And I was invited to a lunch with some of her relatives, and you know, she still leads like somewhat of a pleasant life toward me, even though we've had all this turmoil. I just have to have really good boundaries. But it was a situation where at first I accepted, and then I realized some of these people are new. We've had a lot of turmoil. I haven't talked to her much in a long time. There's just too many elephants in the room for me to not have anxiety. But on another occasion, maybe I'll stop by and have coffee with you, or stop by and see a picture you just hung on the wall. But I can't base that relationship on whether she's high or not. If that makes sense too.
Oh, it does. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because I am a firm believer that the CRAFT method and what Allies in Recovery teaches can be applied to pretty much any controversial
yes.
type situation and communication situation in your life. So I also use the same method. I have someone else in my life who is not using and is very difficult to communicate with and loves to get into arguments. And I am a lot like you, like I get anxious when I'm around them, but, and I set up these boundaries. When can I handle it? When can't I handle it? But I still use the CRAFT method for communication tactics. So if I see that,
self-protection tactics. I love that Dominique said, I'm always going to have that initial triggering where you feel that hot and cold in your shoulders and a pit in your stomach and your pulse in weird places on your body. And you have all the physical effects along with the nervous heartbeat and all of that. I love that you feel that initially, but you've dealt with the reactivity and you've applied the method to your life enough that you're healthy in how you handle it, in how you avoid it or face it or however.
Right. And I have to tell you, I've had a couple of situations with this person and it starts to get heated and I just literally, I gotta go. Literally, will not engage. And it's really helpful.
It's so helpful.
Yeah, it's so helpful. So yes, I agree with you. This is not only about applying it to our loved one that's suffering with SUD. It really is about learning how to communicate, coming up with coping strategies for dealing with difficult situations.
Well, because people are messy and complicated, and life is about trying to get along with each other. And for the most part, people don't get along all the time.
Right.
So this method is, I don't have active addiction near my life right now, thank goodness. Not right now, I don't. And I am realistic about the fact that that could change. But I have a lot of other issues in aftermath that this fits perfectly around.
Right, right. And I also like and would like to stress this, that in with Allies in Recovery and CRAFT, I really like that this method doesn't want us to cut off our communication with our loved one.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want us to, I mean, we've talked about detaching, we've talked about all these other different issues, but the goal is not to cut them off. The goal is to keep the communication open so that we can help and influence in a positive direction. It doesn't always work that way, right? It does not always work that way. I wish it did. But it also, it encourages this respectfulness for our loved ones, right?
Well, it also pulls the focus off the fact that they're the one that's kind of surging with wrong behavior all the time, because it's a family disease. Everyone needs work.
Right. Right. And I think it encourages a whole bunch of things. It encourages us to be respectful. It encourages us to express to them or to show to them that we have faith that they can and handle and do handle situations. It shows them that we believe that they can recover. Right. And it also shows them that, yeah, I still love you, regardless of all this. You know, it kind of takes the shame out of it, I think.
It does, and it makes it not just that they're the focus, because I've got stuff I could handle better too.
Right, right.
In the very beginning, I didn't see it that way, because I didn't see that I was the one with a problem that was causing problems. I saw it that I was affected by the problem. And even if I reacted terrible, well, the problem was making me react terrible.
Right.
I had always been able to kind of be self-aware and self-realizing about things before and look at my side of the street, but not when it came to that at first. I thought I was just right, and I knew what needed to stop, what needed to be done,
right?
And I was right. I just really thought I was right, but I was wrong a lot.
Right, because if they would just, I think you were absolutely right. Because if they would just listen to us, everything would be hunky-dory. Everything would be great. The problem is they won't listen to us. Yeah, I get that. And I still feel that way a lot of the time. I still feel, I still have that, oh, if you would just do what I say, everything would be great, you know?
Yeah, that brings me to a question I ask when it comes to enabling too, and when it comes to even if I'm right. Is my help hindering? Is my help helping? I mean, there's like, when it comes to enabling, you know when your help is no longer helping, because a situation is not only not improving, it's sometimes getting worse. Right. I actually, the definition of enabling is to give someone the authority or means to do something. You give them the authority or the means. That means your hands are on, you're involved, you're helping.
I love that. I love that, because that really tells you, okay, if that's the definition, you can enable good behavior. Well, yes. You can enable bad behavior. Which one are you going to choose?
And right. I would rather empower and encourage than enable.
Right.
I have another question too. Does not enabling fix the problem?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's interesting you say that, because I wrote this down, and I put this in big stars on my paper, and it says, it's important to note that enabling does not mean the person will get sober or go to treatment.
That's so, right. That was another thing I was completely wrong about, because I thought, I'm not enabling. I'm causing so much misery for him. He's going to hate it, and it's going to get solved overnight. And then it was like, even when he got into treatment, he relapsed out there, and it was like, but nobody's enabling him. What is this?
Right. Well,
cutting off enabling does not cure the problem.
Right. And it's, and the whole thing about not enabling, that's not what it's about. That's not what not enabling is about. It isn't about getting them sober or getting them into treatment. it is, on the other hand, about protecting yourself, setting up good boundaries, and following your own morals and values.
Yes, and not participating in the problem. No matter how it is you're participating, if you're participating in the problem, you are a part of the problem.
Right. I wrote this all down. If that's not the goal, then it still is you trying to control the situation, right? If your goal is to get them sober or to get them into treatment, and that's why you're not enabling, then what you're doing is you're trying to control the situation. So that's...
Which means the situation's controlling you.
Right, exactly. So it's important to bear in mind. So if you stop enabling and you only are trying to enable good behavior, right, then it means that if things get worse, which sometimes that happens, in fact, I would say a lot of the time that does happen, right, that it actually, the ante gets ramped up because they're not used to you not enabling, right, or enabling only good behavior, you can't control that. They're gonna do that. So enabling is really about setting up your own boundaries, doing what's right for you, and protecting yourself. And I also look at it as this. I look at it as, because it is protecting myself, because it is holding up to my own morals and my own values, that if the worst things, and it is so respectful and it is an expression of how much I love my child, and it is an expression that I believe in them, that I believe that they can overcome all of this, that if the worst happens, and I mean if he passes away because of substance use, then I know deep inside of myself that I was able to keep the communication open, and he knew that I loved him, and he knew that I did everything I possibly could to get him on a good path.
Right.
And that's all that I can do.
Right. I love that. It's hard when you're fighting against an enabler in the midst of it, whether it's husband and wife, and for me it was mother and my against my mother for her quote enabling. But I remember there were a couple of occasions where my ex-husband enabled a little bit and did a couple of things that were kind of behind my back. And I was like, if we're supposed to be a team here. And one time I'd called him and said, did you help him out and keep this a secret from me? And he said, well, yeah, but it was a test. I wanted to see if he would, you know, have integrity and keep his word or catch him in a lie. And I remember saying, you know, you've had a lot of stupid ideas. And that's, that's really one of the top five. That you're going to help him in the midst of this, keep it a secret from me, be on board with deception,
right,
just to see if you can prove that you're right. And something that's as high level crisis as this, and you think that's wise.
Right.
So he's like, I know, I don't want to hear it, never again.
But wow. I'm sure he was like, okay, I get it, forgive me.
He was like, this is why I hate you, because you call me out and I feel so stupid. I didn't feel as stupid deciding this. And I remember, like, we have to be on the same page. We don't have to constantly agree, but there can't be behind the back secrets and deception, right, when we're dealing with so much of that anyway. And right, that was a learning curve for us both anyway. And I remember saying to him, what was your motive for doing that? And he had felt bad and felt guilty about a few things and wanted to keep the relationship intact. And I mean, it was really, it always comes back to self-motive. And then I remember saying, well, you thought you'd outsmart it. That's what you were trying to do, was outsmart something that is cunning, baffling, and powerful.
Right.
And you didn't. You got all of us stung because of it. So what a great, I mean, I'm not going to beat you to death over it. What a great lesson that we can't play games with this.
Right. Right. I love that. I love that example. Which also brings me to, you know, I think it's really important to pull all of the players together as much as you possibly can, which is an incredibly...
If it's possible.
Yeah, if it's possible. Incredibly difficult thing, because I know all the different moving pieces. I mean, I have a bit of a different situation than you do. One, I'm not divorced. And two, I don't have my mother that involved in it. But I do have my daughters who have also contributed, and we're not on the same page, but it's because I think that we didn't realize at the time that we should get them on the same page,
yeah.
Right? That we should inform them. I mean, I remember one particular time where we had determined, my son had gotten kicked out of a sober house, and my husband and I had decided, no, I'm not paying for a hotel. You know, he had his car, he could sleep in the car, or he was going to have to go to a shelter or something like that. And he called up my daughter, and my daughter paid for a motel room. And he was like, darn, you know. But I also kind of blame myself a little bit because, you know, we should have pulled her into that beforehand and let her know. But even if we had, maybe she still would have done it because maybe she, who knows, she might struggle with it. It's a learning process.
And I think that's why, even though my ex-husband and I were divorced, we were wonderfully unified and have always had a great, joking, fun relationship. I mean, even in, you know, it's like the theater masks are tragedy and humor. We had humor even in the midst of that because we so needed to rely and count on each other. And having that, being on the same page, when one of us did fail or did vent in a crazy manner to the other, we always gave each other that cushion of, okay, we're going through this together. I'm not going to beat you up because you dropped the ball.
Right, right.
It's a learning curve, and nobody's going to get it right. Nobody should have to get it right.
Right.
But eventually you learn how to get better.
Right. Well, this was fun.
Yes, I liked it. That's about all I got.
Yeah, me as well. I really enjoyed that. And
good information. I agree.
Yep. And so I guess until next week, that was enabling. So until, I guess next week we meet again. I'm not sure. I don't think we have a topic next week, do we?
I'm not sure, but we should be out on iTunes soon, which is exciting. And we will have more topics and guests coming up. And hopefully the listeners keep coming back. So until next time, we'll be coming up for air.
Sounds good. And if anybody out there has any questions or a topic that they'd like us to discuss, they can email us on the Allies in Recovery website.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Thank you. Bye, Annie.
Thank you for listening to this Coming Up for Air podcast with Annie Highwater and Lori McDougall. If you're interested in reading Annie's book, Unhooked, A Mother's Story of Unhitching from the Roller Coaster of Her Son's Addiction, it's available online, or you can simply follow the link at the bottom of one of Annie's blog posts on alliesinrecovery.net. Coming Up for Air is sponsored by Allies in Recovery, the online home for families facing the addiction of a loved one. Allies in Recovery can help you understand your loved one's struggle and offers effective communication strategies that encourage treatment and discourage use. In addition to interactive e-learning, Allies in Recovery offers expert advice, podcasts, tools for evaluating treatment options, recent news items, and access to a large community of families coping with issues similar to yours. Join alliesinrecovery.net today. That's alliesinrecovery, all one word, .net. Thank you for listening. Our theme music was performed and composed by cellist Eric Corey.